sixth text now of the Shikshashtakam. Let's recite it together. Nayanam kal nadashtu dharaya vadanam gadgadayutaya jina ulakayam chitam bahugada tavanam grahane bhavishyati. So here, tavanam grahane bhavishyati. In the previous verse, he has prayed, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is praying, please lift me up. Now he is continuing that description of that aspiration by saying that, what do we mean by lift me up? What will happen when I am lifted up? So what will happen when we are lifted up? Then, when we come in spiritual consciousness, we will experience spiritual emotions. And the experience of Krishna within the heart, it has certain external expressions. So, nayanam galadashrudharaya, the eyes will flow with tears. Vadanam gadgal rudayagira. So, the voice will choke up. Pulakair nichitam vapuhu kada. The hair will stand on it. Kada, when will this happen? So, now basically these transformations of the body, of the which reflect the inner emotions. They are the result when there is a lot of intense emotion in the heart. So the internal in this case is producing the external. So when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is saying, when will I get these emotions, when I'll get these ecstatic symptoms, it means he is praying for the internal emotion by which these external symptoms will manifest. Can we turn this on? So, we'll talk about sentiments and sentimentality over here. So, in the Ramayana, there is a beautiful dialogue between Rama and Lakshman, wherein Ram tells Lakshman that actually sentiments are the ornaments of life. And then, so what happens is that when Ram and Lakshman are in the forest, at that time they hear an army coming in. And they are always on the guard because some invaders might come. So then Ram asks Lakshman to climb on a tree and look out. And he looks down and he sees that it's actually the Ayodhya army coming. Ayodhya army. And he sees Bharat at the head. So Lakshman gets angry. And he says, that wicked son of Kaikeyi, you know, he has now come to complete the evil deed that his mother started. She exiled you and now he has come with the whole army to kill you. But he doesn't know that I alone will send him and the whole army to death. So at that time, now Lakshman becomes very angry and Ram tells him that actually, oh Lakshman, Bharat's love for me is as much as is your love for me. That Bharat, I'm sure, he has come to call me back. He's feeling very distressed because Kaikeyi sent me to the forest and he has come to call me back. He says, why are you so upset with him? Is it that Bharat offended you any time? Or is it that when in a rush of emotions you said you will come with me to the forest? But now you are finding the austerity of forest life too much and that's why you are becoming irritable. If that is the case, then when Bharat comes, I will tell Bharat to stay here with me and you can go back and become the ruler. You can go back and become the ruler. Now when Ram speaks this, Lakshman becomes totally deflated. And then actually when there is such a loving, selfless interaction between them, finally, Bharat takes a vow and he says, I will not go back to this forest, out of this forest, unless you come back, unless you accept the throne. So he just sits down in the yogic posture to meditate. And then everybody becomes shocked. Ram says, oh Bharat, your love has won. I accept the throne that you give me. I accept the crown. And he takes the crown. And then Bharat becomes jubilant. And then Ram says, I accept this crown and I entrust it to you for the next 14 years. So he says that actually our father has told me to go to the forest for 14 years. Therefore, I want your cooperation so that I can fulfill my father's instructions. So therefore, you don't want to accept the throne which your mother got from, which Kaikeyi got from Dashrath. So that you didn't want to accept. But you accept this throne on my behalf. So you are ruling on my behalf. Then Bharat says that, okay, if I am ruling on your behalf, then give me some evidence that I am ruling on your behalf. Give me your shoes. So now today, if there is a property dispute between two sons, you know, one son will probably take his shoes and beat it to the other son with it. So actually Bharat puts the shoes on his head and he goes back. And it is the shoes that rule, and he considers himself the representative. So when Lakshman sees all this, he's so moved. And then after that, Lakshman is talking with Ram, and he says, Lakshman apologizes, I became so angry. So then Lakshman says, you know, why do I become angry so quickly? So Ram says, oh Lakshman, you are sentimental. So then Lakshman asks, you know, are sentiments bad? Are sentiments bad? So Ram says, no. Ram replies, no. Sentiments are not bad. He says, sentiments are the ornaments of life. But, he said, we should choose those sentiments that take us towards dharma, not those sentiments that take us away from dharma. So we should choose those sentiments that elevate us, not those sentiments that degrade us. We cannot live without emotions. We all need emotions in our life. But there are certain emotions which take us away from Krishna, which take us away from dharma. Those emotions we have to stay away from. And we choose and nourish and develop those emotions that take us towards Krishna. So now, in that sense, sentiments are important. And bhakti, we could say at the highest level, is a sentiment. The strong sentiment of the heart for Krishna. Now, the difference between sentiments and sentimentality. Sentimentality means the sentiments or the emotions, they are the sole deciders of our actions and our level. That means we think that I feel like this, so then I go in front of Krishna and, you know, the darshan was so beautiful, tears came out of my eyes. Oh, I must be a pure devotee now. But then next day, I go in front of darshan, and I don't feel anything. And you know, darshan arti is going on, I'm looking at the watch, when will this get over? Isn't it? So what happens? If we let emotions alone decide our actions, then we cannot be very committed to the practice of bhakti. Commitment, we discussed yesterday about commitment. At one level, commitment means that it means we go beyond the feelings. No. Whether I feel like it or I don't feel like it, I will do it. You know, when a mother has a baby and the baby starts crying in the middle of the night, the mother cannot say, hey, no, I don't want to take care of the baby. The mother wakes up and takes care of the baby. That is a commitment. So commitment means we are actually ready to subordinate our feelings to our purpose, to our responsibility. Whatever we have taken a commitment for, I may feel like it, I may not feel like it, but I subordinate my sentiments to my purpose, to my responsibility. But in sentimentality, we just let our sentiments decide everything. So when I feel like chanting, I'll chant. When I don't feel like chanting, I just decide I won't chant. So we let everything be determined by sentiments. That is sentimentality. And now here, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is talking about very exalted sentiments, tears coming out of the eyes, bodily hair standing on end, now he is talking about a person who has come to a very high level of spiritual advancement. And then the internal attraction towards Krishna is so great that these ecstatic symptoms are manifesting externally because of that intense attraction. So actually, in the path of sadhana bhakti, here when I use the word reason, I'm using scriptural reason. That means scripturally guided reason. So we have that famous verse from the Puranas that Shruti Smriti Puranadi Pancharatri Ki Vidhim Vina Aikantiki Harer Bhakti Utpata Yaiva Kalpate. That when bhakti is done without scriptural guidance, then that becomes a disturbance in society. So what does scriptural guidance do? That guides our intelligence, that guides our reason. So reason and emotion, at least in the path of sadhana bhakti, they have to go together. So let reason direct emotion. That reason, what does reason mean? That means that, okay, someday I feel ecstatic when I'm chanting. Other days I feel bored. But what is my intelligence? What does my reason tell me? I should do this as a responsibility, as a commitment. So let reason direct emotion. Even if I don't feel like it, I will do it. And I'll try to cultivate as much feeling as possible. And then, on the other side, that is, let emotion animate reason. Now, logic and reason can become very, very cold, very hard. So we need emotion within our logic and reason also. We use scriptural intelligence, scripturally guided intelligence, but scripturally guided intelligence is meant to help us move towards Krishna. So sometimes a person there are scholars who have memorized all the 700 verses of the Bhagavad Gita, and they don't even believe that Krishna existed. So what is happening here? The whole Bhagavad Gita is about devotion to Krishna. They don't even what to speak of devotion to Krishna. They don't even have faith in the existence of Krishna. So what is happening? They may have knowledge. They have intelligence. They may also able to, this verse in Bhagavad Gita says this. This verse in Bhagavad Gita says this. They can give analysis, but they have no emotion, no attraction towards Krishna. So both of them have to go together. The faith and the emotion and the reason both need to go forward straight. Both need to go together, then we will move ahead in bhakti. And if one of them is more as compared to the other, then that can lead to problems. So when there is a lot of reason, but there is no emotion, then that leads to impersonalism. What happens to the impersonalists? They can study scripture also, they can analyze scripture also very nicely. But then, in the process of analysis, they keep analyzing so much, that they see, normally in analysis, you know, we go from specifics to universals. If I'm analyzing something, okay, somebody suddenly became very angry. I'm trying to analyze. Why did they become angry? Maybe he or she is a short-tempered person. Or if somebody just wants to be alone all the time. Maybe they're an introvert. So what are we doing in general? What are we doing when we're analyzing like this? Introvert means a person who wants to be alone all the time. So what are they doing over here? Actually, we are seeing some observations, and then from that we are trying to go towards some universals. Okay, this person wants to be alone, that means they're an introvert. So we are going, basically analysis, when we do analyze things, we try to go from the specific to some universal principle. So like that, when the impersonal, they come, they start analyzing this world. Naiti, you know. There are attractive things in this world, but they are temporary. So we need to go beyond that. Like that, they keep analyzing, they come to Krishna, and they start analyzing Krishna also. They start analyzing Krishna. You know, in India, there is a newspaper, Times of India, and they have a spiritual column called Speaking Tree. So the editor of that column, once she wrote to me, and before Janmashtami, she said, can you write an article about why Krishna is black? And don't give the usual story stuff. Give some new insight. Then I started inquiring, why such a specific question? Why is Krishna black? Then I found out that there's one impersonalist. He has given an explanation. And what is the explanation? He says, actually, black is not considered all that attractive. And God is supremely attractive. So why would anyone conceive of God in the black form? He says the reason is because form means darkness and the Brahman is white. So We have to go beyond the black form to the white light. Now, for the uninformed, this person, hey, fighter, I never knew this. So clever. So then I wrote an article. I took the same reasoning. And I said that, you know, actually, normally, according to normal analysis, say the dark color is not considered so attractive. So why would somebody consider God as dark? See, the fact is, Krishna is not just called as Shyam, he's called Shyam Sundar. So that means Krishna's blackness, Krishna's darkness is not like the darkness of this world. That means there is a transcendental reality in which also there is variety. And in that variety, Krishna is transcendentally beautiful. So the dark color of Krishna, it signifies how the transcendental beauty goes beyond material conceptions of beauty. So I just turned the whole logic around. But the point is that when people do analysis, they basically want to go beyond specifics to some universal. So they often go beyond Krishna also. They want to analyze and they want to go beyond Krishna to something else. So that way, when it happens, they go towards impersonalism. So there is analysis, there is reason, but there is no emotion. Because they think I have to go beyond Krishna. So another way of looking at this is that with reason, by reason I mean not just logic, but with analysis of the material world. So okay, I'll put it this way. This is quite nice. Yeah. So if you can consider four categories of people, we have, can you put a table in this?
Insert.
Table right in the slide.
Table, yeah, okay, fine. One, two, three, four. Okay, fine. So we have Krishna and Maya. So, you know, okay, let me make this a little bit. Is it visible or it's not visible? Sorry?
You can pull it down.
Yeah. Okay, so now if we consider materialists, you know, they are detached from Krishna, and they are attached to Maya. Now, if we consider materialists, okay, sorry. We have Sahajiyas. They're actually attached to Krishna, but they are attached to Maya also. They are involved in worldly things also. The impersonalists, they are detached from Maya, but they are detached from Krishna also. So, the bhaktas, they are attached to Krishna and they are detached from Maya. So, here what happens, that with respect to the impersonalists, they have their reasoning faculty, they have their analytical faculty, and they try to break down everything. And they come to Krishna and they try to analyze Krishna also. And when you analyze Krishna, we try to go beyond Krishna to something else. So the lack of emotions can become an obstacle. There are different ways of appreciating things. Or the impersonalists, by the analysis, they can understand, okay, there's nothing really attractive in this world. They become detached from this world. But they become detached from Krishna also. Because they think I have to go beyond Krishna to something else. So in that sense, that impersonalism is a misunderstanding involved over there. So suppose somebody wants to, there's a beautiful rose flower. Now to appreciate the rose flower, one has to have an aesthetic view. Okay, so beautiful, such fragrance, such shape. Now if I go to a rose flower with a analytical view. And I can say, okay, you know, this is the petal, this is the andrusium, this is the gynoecium, these are the carpel, this is the stamen. And I can go into a biological analysis of all the parts of the flower. And if we study a flower as a botanist, we may get into analysis of all the parts, but then we will not see it as all that attractive. So the attraction comes when there is an approach which is not so analytical as it is aesthetic. So both are ways of looking at things, but if I want to appreciate the flower's beauty, I have to approach it not in an analytical way, but in an aesthetic way. So like that, when we approach Krishna, when we look at the world, for the world there is analysis so that we get detached from the world. But when we approach Krishna, we approach with our heart, with emotions, with bhava. Tesham satyuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. So we have to approach with devotion. So with that, with the approach of aesthetic appreciation, that is the whole concept of rasa in bhakti. So when we approach with that, then we can appreciate Krishna more and more. So here, because the impersonal is, they approach the world in an analytical frame, they also approach Krishna in too much of an analytical frame. Then they want to go beyond Krishna. That's how they detach from matter and they detach from Krishna. Now sahajiyas, they are attached to Krishna, and they like to sing songs about Krishna, they like to hear Krishna Leela, they like to enact dramas about Krishna. But then, they are not discerning enough about the difference between matter and spirit, the difference between the material and the spiritual. And because of that, they on one side seem to have emotions in relationship with Krishna, but then they have worldly emotions also, they have worldly attachments also. So this is, the Sahajiyas actually gave a very bad name to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Yesterday I was talking about how Bhaktivinoda Thakur reformed Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So what happened is, at that time, the Sahajiyas, they were people who took the advanced stages of bhakti very cheaply. And they took Vaishnavism and then they took some elements of Shaktism. And they did a syncretism. Syncretism means you bring two schools of thought together and mix them. So now in Tantra, Tantra is related to Shakta worship. In Tantra, they have the idea, this is a whole big subject. I'll just keep it very brief. Maybe in future I'll talk about it. But in Tantra, they have the idea that when we worship a particular deity, that deity enters into your body. Now, sometimes in some traditional Indian temples, especially temples of the goddess, if we go, sometimes people start dancing wildly. So they say that the person is possessed by the goddess. And then, now there are many people who imitate in this. But they also have their own standards by which they understand whether it's actual possession or it's imitation. But this whole thing is there, that they have the idea that if we have bhava for the person we are worshipping, then that person will enter into us. So what some of the Sahajiyas did is, they took that idea and they brought it into Vaishnavism, and they said that actually when we become absorbed in, say, hearing Radha Krishna's pastimes, then Radha Krishna enter into us. And then not only that, they said further, so there will be Sahajiya men and women, and they would do illicit things, and they would say, actually Radha Krishna have entered into us and they are enjoying through us. So this is so distorted. But so they were not only doing immoral things, they were claiming that it is actually some higher reality entering into us. Now there's no reference to anything like this in Shastra. But so not only were they immoral, but they were rationalizing their immorality based on their syncretistic understanding of Vaishnavism Tantra. And then, so Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they strongly condemned it. So their condemnation of Sahajiyaism was because it was not just, you know, somebody crying tears when they are not really having advanced emotions. Yes, that is okay. That is not such a serious problem. But when somebody starts doing immoral activities like this, and by doing immoral activities, they claim that I am actually, we are at exalted levels of devotion, then it becomes a serious problem. So Sahajiyas, they were actually spreading immorality in society in the name of exalted devotion. So Aikantiki Harer Bhakti Utpata Yaiva Kalpate. So Utpata means disturbance. So it's not that, you know, if somebody goes to a temple and just they seem to have tears in their eyes, that's not going to cause a disturbance in society. Yes, but if somebody is doing like this level of things, then it does cause a lot of disturbance. So immorality was not just being perpetrated, but it was being rationalized in the name of bhakti. And so our acharya is very strongly condemned it. That's why we have repeated cautions against Sahajiyaism in our tradition. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Srila Prabhupada said that this is what happens if we become too sentimental. So we have become too sentimental and let, without having proper philosophical understanding of what is ought, we basically drag down the spiritual down to the material level. And then that leads to problems. So now with respect to sentiments, so sentimentality is bad. But sentiments are not necessarily bad. Sentiments are actually desirable on the path of bhakti. So there is sentimentality, and the opposite of it is also undesirable, and that is judgmentality. So as a bhaktas, we shouldn't be sentimental, at the same time we shouldn't be judgmental. That means what? Sentimental means, you know, we just, some people always, you know, they just become over emotional all the time, and that is undesirable. But seeing this, some others may become judgmental. You know, if somebody becomes excited, say when kirtans are going on, Sanai Darshan is there, they become effusive. And others say, very judgmental, very sentimental person. Not, we are becoming judgmental. That is, judgmentality means unfeeling imposition of standards on others. Is, you know, we just judge everybody. It's like this, like this, like this, like this. Judgmental means we are not actually putting our heart in understanding other situations. So I'll talk about it at three, four different levels. In fact, I have a whole series of seminars on cultivating non-judgmental attitude. I did the seminar in Brisbane this year when I was there. And after the three-part seminar, one Mataji, she came with her husband and she was telling, you know, how she could very much connect with the seminar. First, she was from Bengali background, Bengali Shakta background. And she had come first time to a temple. And there in the temple, she saw that some Matajis were doing garlands. She also went there and joined. She started doing garlands. And suddenly, some devotee came there. And in front of everyone, he asked her, "Do you eat meat?" And now she did not. "Do you eat meat?" And she's from Shakta background. In Shakta culture, they eat meat actually. She just nodded her head. And the senior devotee just grabbed the garland from her hand, hurled it on the ground. He says, "You cannot even touch the flower that had to be used for the deity worship." And she was just shattered. Just went out of the temple crying in tears. Now, this is her sincerity that again, that she still, and she met some other devotees who are a little more sensitive, a little more mature. She connected with them. Now she's an initiated devotee practicing bhakti. You know, she said that it was heartbreaking for her at that time. So now, it may be that in a particular temple, certain standards are followed. Okay, some people cannot make garlands for the deities. But somebody is themselves coming and making garlands, I mean, they have a service attitude. And the service attitude is to be appreciated. The service attitude is to be nurtured. It's not that in the name of our standards, we condemn others. So, unfortunately, you know, our spirituality should make us more understanding. But it often makes us more judgmental. Instead of making us more understanding, that, you know, just as I have my own struggles at my level, others have struggles at their level. So, but for them, their struggles may be as difficult as the struggles are for me at my level. Because the principle is we have to move from one level to another, and the steps always take some time. So for me, I may be fasting with water, but for me, fasting nirjal is very difficult. So that is a struggle for me if I want to fast nirjal. for somebody else, you know, just living on without grains for one day itself is very difficult. But you know, for them to come to that level also is a struggle, just as for me to go from jal to nirjal is a struggle. So bhakti is a progression, and we need to encourage people to move onwards. Even if they are at a lower standard, we need to interact in a way by which they rise to a higher standard. Not that we condemn them just because they are at a lower standard. So if we become judgmental, we alienate a lot of people. We alienate people because we label them. You're like this, you're like this, you're like this. So here what is happening? When we are, it is judgmentality I'm talking about, where there is no emotion only. There is only reason. As scriptural standard, you know, this is a standard. And then I'm going to impose a standard no matter whatever what happens to me. Now, but people come from different backgrounds. People have different situations. And then, through it all, if I start imposing my standards on others, we can actually alienate a lot of people. So I'm saying this, I've also been guilty of judging others, and not have been, even now I am guilty. So once I was in Radha Gopinath temple in Chowpatty, and I had come for lunch, and when I came for lunch, it was some feast was there, so there was sweet made over there, but I had come a little late, so the sweet was over. So I felt a little bad, I'm not getting any sweet. And there was one senior devotee sitting over there, opposite to me, and I could see that in his plate there was a sweet, and he had taken it. And he was asking everyone, do you have some sweet? Do you have some sweet? Now I was watching it, I think he already had one helping. He's asking for more. You know, it is like one server said there are people serving, and one server said there's no sweet. But he was asking a second server, is there a sweet? Do you have a sweet? Do you have a sweet? And four or five people he was asking. And because he was a senior devotee, everybody was running around. Is there some sweet somewhere? Is there some sweet somewhere? So I was becoming quite critical. And then finally, one devotee, like sometimes when prasad is served, the servers, they actually keep their prasad for themselves. And then, the one devotee from his own plate, he brought the sweet. He said, Proji, please take this. I was like, this is too much. You know, you already had your sweet. You're taking sweet from somebody else's plate. And then, as that devotee was about to serve into his plate, that devotee said, no, not for me, for him. And he pointed to me. So, he was asking everyone for sweet because he saw that I had not got the sweet. Now, I just thought at that time, if that last part had not happened. I would have carried a critical impression of that devotee, you know, oh, sense gratifier. You know? So quite often, you know, we have a limited picture of things. And based on our limited picture, if we start evaluating others, we can alienate a lot of people. So we should not be judgmental. Now with respect to sentiments also, by some people's nature, some people will be more sentimental. Some people will be less sentimental. Some people will be more analytical, more logical. And just as for those people whose mind is stronger, very strong, for them sentimentality is a danger. But for those whose intelligence is stronger, for them judgmentality is a problem. I like this, like this, like this, like this. So some people may have more sentiments than others. They may be more sentimental also. But as long as they are practicing the process of bhakti, they will also move onwards. We don't have to become judgmental about others. I suppose some devotee comes and says, yesterday Krishna came in my dream. Now, what will I say? Krishna came in my dream. What will you say at that time? Like, yes, Sahajya, Krishna cannot come in that dream. Can we say it? It will be very hurting if somebody says like that. I have seen you sleeping and chanting. Krishna cannot come in this person. I dream of someone who sleeps and chanting. I can bring my own correlation. Now, firstly, who am I to say that Krishna cannot do something? Isn't it? Krishna can come in anyone's dream. Krishna is Swarat. So thing is that all of us, it is possible that we can also have some special experiences. Sometimes Krishna may come in the dream. Sometimes, you know, we go and take darshan of the deities and we get tears. In kirtans, we may feel very uplifting experiences we may have. And now when we have these experiences, No, it is not necessary that these are all sentimental. The important thing is that what we do after that. Okay, Krishna came in my dream. But what after that? You know, that Krishna came in my dream, that is Krishna's mercy on me. My reciprocation is what I do after waking up. Isn't it? Krishna coming in my dream, that alone doesn't make me spiritually advanced. That is Krishna's special mercy by which it has happened. So I take that gratefully, and then I use it to become more inspired in my bhakti, more dedicated in my bhakti. So if we have some spiritual experiences where we feel some ecstasy, where we feel some joy, we experience some very deep emotions in relationship with Krishna, we see that as Krishna's mercy. We don't have to go into a very critical analysis in terms of if it's happening to others, you know, is this genuine or is this sahajayik? The important thing is, yes, Krishna can give experiences like this to anyone, but what will lead to spiritual advancement is the steady practice of bhakti. So generally, if we have some experiences like this, then we can see them as Krishna's mercy, and we reciprocate by trying to become more devoted to service of Krishna. It is not that these extraordinary experiences, so I say sometimes when we are in a kirtan, you know, our hair stands on end. It's not that we have to take a photograph and that put on Facebook and everyone see, you know, oh, just see how I got ecstasy, my hair is standing on end. We don't have to go and advertise that to the world. It is possible. Krishna is Swarat and Krishna can give us experiences like that. But when you get some experiences like that, we are grateful to Krishna and we practice bhakti with greater dedication, greater inspiration. So it's like something which is going to come to us as we advance further on the path of bhakti. Krishna has given us a glimpse of that now. And by that glimpse, we feel inspired to move further, faster on that path. So it is not that these symptoms alone are the sign of spiritual advancement. These symptoms, we have to see them in connection with the whole life of bhakti. And if the symptoms come without a life very, very, very purely or seriously dedicated to bhakti, then they are not so much as symptoms of spiritual advancement, rather they are precursors. They are advanced samples. Now we are getting in advance what we can get in future. We're just getting a glimpse of that. And that glimpse should inspire us to move onwards. And that way, even if we get some experiences like this, we accept it gratefully. Now we see that Madhavendra Puri, in his pastimes with Gopalji, what happens is that Gopalji comes in his dream multiple times. The first time when he comes in the dream, that actually brings glory to Madhavendra Puri. Oh, I'm lying here, please come and rescue me and build a temple for me. Now then all the villagers come and they are stunned. Oh, you've got a dream and actually the Lord is here. So that actually makes Madhavendra Puri very famous. Very, very special. What a great soul that the Lord came in his dream. Now the next time when he comes in the dream, actually what the Lord tells, I am feeling very hot. Go to Puri and get some chandan for me. Actually this instruction is very troublesome. Madhavendra Puri could have said, you know, Krishna did not come in my dream only.
You know, if he had been concerned with just getting the glory,
in the first dream he brings glory, but the second dream actually is causing so much inconvenience. So he could have said, oh, maybe, you know, it is after all only a dream. Why take it seriously? No, he took that also seriously. So his concern was service to Krishna. In the first case, the service brought him glory. The service of finding out where the deities are and having the deities excavated and having a temple built, that brought glory for him. And the second dream, that actually subjected him to a lot of austerity. Not just austerity, risk also. You know, to travel through all that areas where even the Muslim rule was there. So, but in both cases, he accepted what was there in the dream. Because his mood was service. So, we can also have some special spiritual experiences in various ways in our life, and we don't have to be hypercritical and reject them all as sahajyas. But then we don't have to highlight them too much, because they alone are not the sign of spiritual advancement. If somebody has those experiences, they can see it, they're grateful for it, and become more inspired in practice of bhakti. And maybe with some close friends, we share it, and who will understand. But we don't have to broadcast it to the whole world. Oh, this I had this, therefore I just understand what a great devotee I am. It's not like that. These are Krishna's mercy, and we see it as Krishna's mercy and try to become more dedicated to Him. So that way we can avoid both the sentimentality and judgmentality. So if we have some sentiments, we are grateful for them and we move forward in our bhakti using those sentiments. In the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there are these Ashta Sattvika Vikar that are described, which are what repeatedly Chaitanya Mahaprabhu exhibits. And we see great Vaishnavas also exhibiting that. But along with that, in the Bhakti Sama Sindhu, there is also a whole other list of characteristics described of a Mahabhagavat, of an advanced devotee. And whereas these eight characteristics, the Ashtasattvic Vikar, they are to some extent imitable. Now, I have to get tears in my eyes. I just put some onion near my eyes, tears will come out. Isn't it? So, these symptoms can be imitated. But there are other symptoms that are described, other characteristics of advanced devotee that are described, they are not imitable. For example, one of them is avyartha kalatvam. Avyartha kalatvam is not wasting any time. Using all the time in Krishna's service. Now, a person who is sahajya, who is just doing a show, they cannot do that. Because they will want a change, they will want a break, and they will want to do so many other things apart from bhakti. So, if someone is really devoted to Krishna, that avyartha kalatvam, that is something which is a more reliable characteristic of serious devotion. Or nama gane sadaruchi, constant eagerness to glorify Krishna, to chant His names. Samutkanta, eagerness to hear about Krishna. And so like that, there's a whole list of characteristics here in Bhakti Sama Sindhu, which are non-imitable. And these are far more reliable parameters of bhakti. And if you see Prabhupada's life, there are some special occasions when Prabhupada went into ecstasy when he was singing Jai Radha Madhav or something like that. But overall, Prabhupada did not talk too much about his Ashtasattvika Vikar. He focused on those non-imitable, tangible parameters where one is not wasting any time, when one is detached from material things, when one is eager to hear about Krishna, eager to speak about Krishna. And those are the characteristics which we can aspire for. If we aspire, oh, when will tears come from my eyes? When will my hair stand on it? It's fine. But these are the results of advanced devotion. And that advanced devotion we cultivate by using our time effectively in Krishna's service, by being eager for hearing about Krishna, eager to speak about, eager to sing Krishna's glories, eager to share Krishna's message. So those qualities we focus on, and these qualities, if you look at that whole list will take some time to discuss. But in the Nectar of Devotion, that list is there. And if you look at it, we'll see Prabhupada demonstrated that list in such an extraordinary way. So we focus in our practice of bhakti on not so much on the ecstatic symptoms. They will come of their own course. But if we focus on the characteristics of a serious bhakta, then by trying to develop those, we can also move forward. And as we move forward, eventually these ecstatic symptoms will also manifest. And thus, we can also relish in our own small way what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is relishing. So I'll summarize. And you can have questions. I started by talking about how there is sentiments are desirable on the path of bhakti. Lord Ram told Lakshman that sentiments are ornaments, but we should choose the sentiments that take us towards dharma, not those which take us away from dharma. And in sentimentality, what happens? Sentiments, they become the driving force. And then if the sentiments are there, I do dharmic activities. If the sentiments are not there, I give up dharmic activities. Because I don't feel like it, I stop chanting. So that is undesirable. Then we discuss further about sentimentality and sentiments. The balanced state is that reason. Reason means scripturally guided intelligence. Reason and emotion, they have to be together in the path of bhakti. So we don't let just emotions run wild. We regulate and direct the emotions using reason. And we also, when we are using reason, we just don't become hyper-analytical. We also animate our reason, our study of scripture, our analysis with a mood of bhakti. So reason without emotion, that leads to impersonalism. Because whenever we are too analytical, we actually cannot develop attraction to anything. Because whatever is attractive, we try to dissect it into its components. And we try to go beyond that. So that leads to impersonalism. And emotion without reason, where there is no regulation, where there is no scriptural understanding, then the material and the spiritual get mixed up. That leads to Sahajiyaism. We discussed about how materialists are, they are detached from Krishna and attached to matter, attached to worldly things. Sahajiyas are attached to Krishna, but they are attached to Maya also. The impersonalists, they are detached from both Krishna and Maya. Where the Bhaktas are, they are detached from the world and they are attached to Krishna. And this is the healthy state. So I discuss about Sahajiyaism. What happened in Sahajiyaism is how it is just somebody shedding tears when they are not actually having ecstasy. That is not going to cause a social disturbance. But the social disturbance that is talked about is when Sahajiyas, they did immoral things and they rationalized it as transcendental. When they imagined that Radha Krishna are entering into their bodies and they are performing pastimes through us. So our acharyas strongly warned us against Sahajiyaism. But that does not mean that there is no role for sentiments in bhakti. I would discuss, if we experience some spiritual, we have some spiritual experiences, we feel some ecstasy. So we see that, not that proof that I have advanced, rather, this is Krishna's mercy revealing to me what awaits me ahead. Therefore, let me follow this process enthusiastically, by which I will come to that level. So Krishna can come in our dreams, but our advancement doesn't depend on whether Krishna comes in my dream or not. Our advancement depends on how I am using my free will to go towards Krishna, what I do after I wake up. So we have to not be sentimental, but we have to also avoid the other extreme of going towards judgmentality, where we just have some idea, some particular conception of what spiritual advancement means, and we just unfeelingly apply that standard on everyone else. So I discussed that example of flower garlands and sweet, how we can actually hurt others terribly or judge others wrongly if we do this. So when the mind is too strong, we tend to become sentimental. When the intelligence is too strong in terms of hyperanalysis, we become judgmental. So bhakti means we have to go beyond the mind and the intelligence to the level of the soul. That is how we become transcendental. And in our journey towards transcendence, we focus not so much on the ecstatic symptoms, which can be imitable, but we focus more on the characteristics of dedication. That is, not wasting time, eagerness to hear about Krishna, and eagerness to share Krishna's glories, those kind of characteristics which Prabhupada exhibited. And by that, we'll steadily move forward and eventually we'll come to the exalted level where we'll also experience the ecstatic symptoms of bhakti that are described in this verse of Shikshashtaka. Any questions or comments? Yes, Janmashtami.
There is an important element of discrimination for a devotee who actually trained to help somebody. Judgmentality, judging means like a negative kind of thing, but discrimination
is
positive and helpful. Definitely. How can I best help this devotee? You know, this is level of evolution and me trying to take it further.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. So discrimination is desirable because we have to guide devotees. Yes, there's the major difference between judgmentality and being judgmental and being discriminating is how we view ourselves. If I put myself in a holier-than-thou attitude, and I look down at others, and then I pass comments about others, then that is judgmental. So, but if we understand that, okay, we are all following a particular process, and in that process, there are certain things which are beneficial, certain things which are harmful, and then we share that knowledge with others. So that is not only desirable, it's essential. To some extent, if we see, the discrimination is the characteristic of the Madhyamadhikari. The Madhyamadhikari discriminates between the Lord is the object of devotion, the devotees are the ones with whom I become friends, the ignorant, the innocent, I give mercy to them, and the envious, I stay away from them. So that kind of discerning is essential for a Madhyamadhikari. But that should not be done in a way which we put ourselves in a superior position, or we become completely insensitive to other people's emotions. But discerning is definitely required. So there is usually the word judgmentality has a very negative connotation. So
seems to be an expression of envy, almost.
Judgmentality, yeah. Almost like envy, yes. When we are judgmental, then basically it is... We put ourselves on a pedestal by which, you know, we can pass statements about everyone else. So that becomes, it is very alienating for people. Yes, sir.
Well, life is all about discrimination in one sense. So judgmental, you know, you're asking people not to be discriminating in one sense.
Oh. Isn't life all about discriminating about things? So if we say that we should not be judgmental, then how should we? Yeah, actually, certainly we all have to make choices. Every morning when we wake up, in a whole day we have to make choices. Should I do this or should I do that? And we use our intelligence to make choices. If we don't use our intelligence, then we will be misled. So in that sense, discrimination is vital. Tasmat shastram pramanam te karya karya vastito. Gyantva shastra vidhanam karma kartum iharasi. In 16.24, Krishna says that, therefore, based on Shastra, know what is to be done, what is not to be done, and then live accordingly. So discrimination is fine. It is not, that is essential for, it's like if a person is sick, then the sick person has to be always aware, okay, if I eat this food, this will worsen my condition. I have to take this medicine at this time, I have to take this at this time. So that, and I should not take this, or I should not go here. So a sick person has to discriminate between what is good for my health and what is not good for my health. So like that, as sadhakas, we do need to discriminate what is going to decrease my bhava roga, decrease my material attachments and material disease, and what is going to increase that disease. So when we are talking about judgment, not being judgmental, it is more in terms of the attitude rather than the principle. The principle of discerning is required, but the attitude with which it is done, that can be very alienating. So if I do it in a way which, where I don't consider other people's feelings, if I don't consider other people's feelings, then we can hurt a lot of people. So a simple, even if I use the continue the medicine example, there also, say somebody has got an infectious disease. Then the doctor has to, a doctor may have to keep the person away from others. But then that also can be done in a respectful way. It's not that we deride and mock the person. So just as there can be discrimination which is done, but it can be done in a sensitive way. It is not that that has to be done in a judgmental way. Like in the past when people would have leprosy. No, it was leprosy is an infectious disease, so lepers need to be kept away from others. But it was almost like leprosy was seen not just as a disease, but it was seen as a sign of a moral deficiency. Where, you know, lepers would be looked down upon and mocked and all those things would happen. So that is wrong. So the principle of discrimination is essential, but the attitude which you do it, that is also important. Otherwise, we may defeat our purpose. Now, we have to speak the truth. And truth involves speaking the truth means telling this is right, this is wrong. But we have to speak the truth in a way that attracts people to the truth, not alienates people away from the truth. So if we speak things in a very judgmental way, then people just go away. Does it address your question?
I think it wasn't exactly a question.
Okay, it is a comment. Fine.
It was a comment on...
But is it, does it address the comment what I spoke?
You're perfect. The attitude is that people sense that the important thing.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, true.
In management generally, without being judgmental, it is very difficult to designate some certain work to people. And obviously, in a crude way, favoritism is also involving some judgmental. Like if I'm giving a particular service to a devotee, I think that he can do it. And I would have asked someone else, they said, no. Like for example, you know, you go and do this particular service, you would say, no, I can't do it. Then we develop an attitude that probably, you know, he doesn't like me. Or he wouldn't do if I say. Then we approach a person who will do that. So there is also favoritism, and I'm also being judgmental. Next time I wouldn't ask the devotee who refused me first time.
Okay. I think if in management do we have to be judgmental or favorite
play favorites by giving services to those people who take and those who are likely to say no, just avoid them. See, we shouldn't confuse different concepts. There is, we could say that when Krishna says, yatha mam prapadyante, tam sataiva bhajamyaham, that all people, as people surrender, I reciprocate. There also Krishna is discriminating in a sense. If you surrender more, I'll reward you more. So, but actually, that is not discrimination, that is reciprocation. And reciprocation is actually natural to relationships. You know, say for example, if after a class we go approach a speaker, and then that speaker is just sitting like unfeeling stone, and then you go and appreciate, no emotion at all. You know, you go and speak something, no emotion anyway. Okay. You might say, okay, this is a very stoic person or whatever. But then, how much of a relationship can we develop with a person? So, relationship means, okay, somebody is appreciating, then they talk more, and then there's further discussion. So, we cannot have that idea that there can be no reciprocation. Relationships means there are reciprocation. So, in reciprocation, there is no discrimination because depending on how people are acting, we are responding. So, for example, say after a class, a speaker spends more time with one person and doesn't spend time with another person. Say they're discriminating. Well, no. This person went and approached, and that's why the speaker is talking. Somebody else didn't approach, how can the speaker talk with them? So now it could be that there are two people, they both want to talk, and the speaker chooses to talk with one person. Or that may also be simply a matter of priority, not a practicality. You know, this person is there closer or whatever. That may be a reason. But that's not necessarily discrimination. So if somebody expresses, if somebody has shown through their actions that they are reliably doing service, and then we give interest in service again, that's a reciprocation. That's not discrimination. So when it becomes discrimination is that deliberately we neglect someone. When we deliberately think that this person I'm not going to allow for whatever reason, then that is discrimination. But reciprocation is essential in bhakti. It's a fundamental fact of life, and it's essential in life in general. So, when because of some biases, we don't give people a chance only, that is discrimination. But if you've given somebody an opportunity and they don't accept it, then we neglect it. That's reciprocation. Yeah.
That applies for the first time, Prabhu, but when it comes to the second time, like, you know, we already made a judgment, he won't help me. Isn't that a being judgmental, that I won't approach him?
Yeah, but we also have, there is, that way we could say Prabhupada also judgmental. Prabhupada tried to preach in India. He said Indians are not interested. So he came to America. There was a call that he took. And he came to America and he found people interested in America. And then afterwards he was going to America and coming into India also. And then he felt that in America my disciples can preach. I'll stay in India. I'll focus on India. So in one sense, any service that we do, we have to make choices. And we make choices based on our experience, how people are reciprocating, our priorities. That's not necessarily wrong. Because we all have certain priorities in our life. We are being given certain instructions. We have certain inspiration. So discrimination would basically mean that we just don't give, we don't give people a chance and we obstruct people when they want to do something. Like say discrimination means Haridas Thakur wants to come enter the Jagannath temple, but he's not allowed to enter the Jagannath temple. So that is discrimination. So that is undesirable. I mean, somebody wants to do it, they're not allowed to do it. But if it is, you know, if there's a person who has been standing in the queue for a long time, they've been standing for 3 hours, and somebody has just come 5 minutes ago. Naturally, the person who is first in the queue, they will go inside first. That's not discrimination. That you came earlier, so you can go in first. That's simply reciprocation. Does that address the question?
Thank you.
So I think we'll continue our question answers in our next session. And we'll have time for more also at that time.
I have an important announcement before everybody leaves. The Krishna Institute.